Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I hear him chatting the noise. Move too quick, can't stop for the talking. I hear him chat with the boys. Man's so tough, but minds keep walking.
Welcome to Cancer Now.
Gary Juden.
How you doing?
Very good eyes, eh? Thanks for having me on.
welcome to the studio here. Now, for regular listeners, Bluey is not here. He is building scaffold somewhere. It's one of these very few and far between dry days here in Newcastle. So he's building scaff out there with all the Kiwis.
Oh,
so that's good.
Shout out to Bluey.
Good on you, Blue. Enjoy yourself, mate.
Where would we be without scaffolders?
I know. Well, hey, you know, the unsung heroes.
And, exactly.
And if you don't know Gary Jubelin, Australia's most decorated detective, perhaps.
I don't know about decorated. infamous.
Do they get decorated?
You get decorations, but I've never been a big one for the decorations.
Well, in my eyes, you're the most decorated.
I got runner-up for the Policeman of the Year award one time.
That's good.
But there had never been a runner-up before. You're either the Policeman of the Year or not Policeman of the Year. And I got a call from a senior police officer and said, congratulations. And I didn't even know about the award. He said, you're runner-up to Policeman of the Year. And I've gone, oh, that's good. Well, thank you. And who won? And he was a little bit hesitant to say that. And he just, oh, some young bloke, blah, blah, blah. And I was a detective at that stage working a lot of major crime. And it was a person that worked for the transit police who had given out a lot of tickets.
A person from the transit police won over a detective.
Yeah, and look, I'm not diminishing.
No, I think you should. I think you should diminish the transit police.
No. Everyone plays an important role, but it was a bizarre.
Yeah, like Bluey with the scaffold.
Bluey, he could be the scaffold of the year.
Maybe.
Scaffolder of the year. But it was a strange situation. So I rang someone higher up and said, what's the go with the runner-up? Because you can't be sort of the second best. It's either the police officer of the year. There is no runner-up. There never has been a runner-up or whatever. And I don't know, it just got lost in the history of the New South Wales police, and still to this day I didn't know why I got runner-up, and there's never been a runner-up policeman of the year since, and there wasn't one before. I got a little TV.
You got a telly?
Yeah,
nice.
Because on principle I wasn't going to accept the prize, and they said, oh, it's a nice TV. I said, okay.
Well, the New South Wales police, you know, great organisation. They've done well. on the topic of crime, I wanted to show you this. This is a very special clock that I bought, not just for you. I bought it just because I'm a weird person. I like buying interesting things, and it's not a gift either. I'm keeping this. But I thought you might want to just have a look at it and get what type of feelings do you get from this particular clock?
Well, I'm just checking about the fingerprints because I've got the fingerprints all over it now. But Chappelle.
What do you think when you hear the name Chappelle?
I'm thinking of Boogie Board.
You are correct.
I'm thinking
this was made by Australia's biggest ever drug smuggler, Chappelle Corby.
Wow. Was it gift wrapped? Was it wrapped in the...
It was not wrapped. Oh, no, it was wrapped. It was sent in a very nice box. She wrote some nice little words on the
checking.
Back.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. So that's where she's doing. Yeah. That's what she's doing now.
No, well, good luck to her. Like, whatever happened, whatever, you know, people's views on it, she went through a rough time, and I don't, spending time in the prison like she did, it would have been a tough...
In a Balinese prison as a young person, I think she would only have been in her early 20s, wouldn't she?
Yeah, and the attention on her as well. Mm. Like, I'm not judging on what she was convicted of or the nature of the offence, but, she's paid the price, so hopefully life's good for her. I didn't bring a gift, but you meant to?
No, this is not gift for you. This is not a gift. I'm not giving it to you.
No, but Chappelle bought the gift.
No, she hasn't been on the show. I bought this.
Right.
It was $200.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. All right. Yeah. I've got it.
You can take it if you want, but I will buy a new one.
Need a new watch. No, that's very good. Very good.
Now, you cancelled on me last week.
Yes.
You had COVID again.
Yeah, I'm 10 days clean.
Nice, very good. Yep. You're getting it out of your system.
It was funny getting COVID at this stage because it was such a yesterday's sort of...
No one cares.
No one cares.
It's been done.
Like if you had COVID 2 years ago, everyone's going, oh, Isaac, he's got COVID. Oh. And I'd be telling people I've got COVID and they go, oh, yeah. What else is going on? Yeah.
We had this conversation, Claire and I, yesterday of the time we were out the front, like for a couple of weeks there, talking to our neighbours, but with like a 10 metres distance in between each other because we didn't want to get arrested or fined or whatever.
Oh, it was strange.
It's changed.
Yeah.
How was it for you? It was fine?
I was crook for a couple of days, but if it didn't have the word COVID attached to it, I would have thought I had a man cold.
Yeah.
And I probably would have bounced back. But it's okay. I know it affects everyone differently, but... Yeah, I feel all right. It made me slow down and lock myself away for a week, so that was pretty good.
Well, there's still. I was talking to a friend of mine who is not vaccinated, and he travels to America or did travel to America quite a bit for work, and he is still unable to travel.
Yep.
Even though I've only had two jabs, the last one being in probably September last year or thereabouts. Yep. And they say that the vaccination only lasts 6 months.
Yeah,
I would imagine that I am completely unprotected by those means, and yet he still can't travel because he hasn't had something 12 months ago.
Yeah, it's
very strange.
It is strange. I travel overseas since COVID. I went to the Maldives, and we were worried whether you're going to get through this checkpoint or that checkpoint, but it seemed fairly relaxed. You wear the mask on the plane and different things, but I hope we're over the worst of it. And that's what the so-called experts are saying, that we've hit the peak. So hopefully.
I caught the flu this year. It was horrible. I thought I was going to die. It was so bad.
Look, I can sympathise. Oh, that man flu is worse.
It's terrible. Yeah. I was like, we had to get to the airport. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make this. This is awful, but I lived.
Well, I haven't been as sick as I've been in the last 12 months, and I wonder if it's because we live such a sterile existence in the COVID, wash your hands and not coming into contact. But before I went over to the Maldives, the day before, I got sick, and I was on an island, and if you had a temperature, you get put into isolation and all that. So there was a couple of days I was walking around with my I went over there with a group of mates and doing a bit of surfing, and I was walking around like Weekend at Bernie's because we had to pretend I was all right.
We didn't just smile on your face.
Yeah, no, I'm fine because we didn't want anyone to know I was sick. But
well, you don't want to be in another country that's sort of still freaking out about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when COVID first hit, I remember we spoke on the phone and you had been in lockdown in your apartment for 6 months or something. Yeah. You couldn't get out. It was like a prison.
Bouncing off the walls. I think I said to you back then, I realised how boring I actually was.
Yeah.
Like living with myself. What are we doing today, Gary? I'm not sure.
Did you get a lot of work done then? Because you are releasing a new book. It comes out in September, is that correct?
Yeah.
So Badness.
Badness, that's correct. It sort of forces you to do work. But you also fall into the trap, I think, that, well, if I don't do it today, I can do it tomorrow because every day blends into it. But no, I finished the book. It's at the printers now, and co-wrote it with Dan Box, who's based over in London. So there was a lot of late night calls and to-ing and fro-ing. But after I finished the first book, I said I'd never do it again. And after I finished the second book, I'll never do it again.
Right.
It's I enjoy it. It's cathartic, like putting everything down. This book's a little bit different because it's not my first one, I Catch Killers, was a memoir. So that's sort of the story read itself. This one's a continuation of my journey since I left the cop. So it's now been 3 years or a bit over 3 years, I think, and what I've discovered since then. So speaking to not just the people I have on the podcast that I do, like other cops, but speaking to some of the ex-crooks or current crooks and just getting a real insight into what causes them to go into a life of crime. And I found it quite interesting. But the really what I think, and it's the thing that rocks my boat at the moment, is how people are fighting crime in different ways, not from a policing point of view, but people that are doing like one Ken Marsloo, whose son was killed in an armed robbery. He's got this program called Enough is Enough, and it's about reducing violence. Voices Survivor, Russell Manser, an armed robber, escapee, all sorts of things, spent 23 years in jail. He was sexually assaulted when he was a kid in an institution, and that, not he's not blaming everything for his life, but that set him on a path that you know, just led to spending so much time in jail. And then there's another fella, Shane Phillips, an Aboriginal man at Redfern, and he does boxing, tribal warrior, and clean slate program where he gets the Indigenous kids out boxing in the morning and different things like that. And it's made me think, here I was thinking I'm the hard-ass crime fighter all those years in the cops, and really when it's all said and done, the difference these people are making doing programs like that is bigger than what I ever achieved in police. So I'm really finding that interesting. It's just changed my view. I'm looking at life a little bit differently, not through a cop's eyes. Mm. So yeah.
So what can people take away from this book, do you think? What is your goal from it?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because when it was put to us about doing it, or put to me about doing a second book, and I spoke to Dan about it, and you know, we could put my name on it and we could there and just sort of sell out and
yeah.
Nothing proud of, because you've got to do the you know, tour, the book tour, and talk about the book. But this, I think, has really given – we're trying to understand badness, what causes badness. Yeah, we delve into some of the big crimes, Anita Cobby, an unsolved murder that I did when I was in the police where a young girl was murdered, 13-year-old girl, and different things like that. And we're looking at, okay, what causes these crimes? Looking at Martin Bryant, we spoke to the crime scene officer that was
oh, really?
Down there and looking at the carnage that occurred down there. And then Tim Watson Munro, who the Hoddle Street Massacre. Tim Watson Munro didn't do the Hoddle Street Massacre. That was Julian Knight. Tim Watson Munro is a criminal psychologist, and he was working with Julian Knight. And it's interesting. You see that tipping point where people, yeah, it's almost like you look at it, and when you look back, it's almost like it's inevitable. So that's sort of the journey that the book covers. This is a long answer to a short question. But then I'm looking at the other people that are fighting crime, victims, and how they've been touched by crime, and just different ways what happens in prison. I became really good friends with a interesting character, and sadly he's passed away. That's Bernie Matthews. And Bernie Matthews was one of the hardest prisoners in New South Wales. He was, you know, he had a book came out, Mr. Intractable, because he was put up in Grafton, where some horrendous things happened to them. And I'm not excusing the crimes that Bernie committed, but I became good friends with him and before he passed away. And his childhood and the brutality that he suffered in the prisons at Grafton, where they'd get bashed when they came in. And this is not talking out of school. This is all public record. And you can almost look at it and think, okay, why did this person go that bad? And then he was talking about all the other people he served time with. And, you know, Bernie got – he was the longest-serving prisoner in Katingle, which was a supermax. And, yeah, he went through some tough times. And, yeah, he would be hard to handle. At one point he tried to kill a corrective services officer by biting his neck. Like, yeah,
shit.
Yeah, like that's how violent he could be. But when you break it down, there was – he was a really smart person. He was a good journalist. So he was mentoring me in some of the journalistic work, because he's an award-winning journalist when he had been out of prison.
Really?
Yeah. So wow. I found hanging out with people like that, and one of the guests that you've had had on your podcast, Graham Henry, I've got to know him pretty well. We grew up in the same area. He was a few years ahead of me and I was terrified by him. He's done some bad things, but then you look at the way his upbringing and that, and you almost understand it. So the type of people I'm speaking to are not the ones that are still encouraging, you know, crime or supporting crime, but it's just trying to understand why they went down that path. And I think that's what comes out in the book. So it's sort of taking the reader on a journey with myself, how I'm sort of changing my views. I haven't become soft. Like I'm not, yeah, I'm still, you know, you do the crime time, you do the crime, you do the time type attitude. But it's made me look at life a little bit differently, which is healthy, I think.
And Graham is just such a fascinating person. I spoke to him, I listened to your episode on your podcast, Catch Killers, with him.
Yeah.
And just listening to him talk in depth about his childhood, and you think to yourself, how does this dude come out any other way?
Yes, yep.
Like there's no way that this man can come out any other way other than a violent human being. And he is a very nice dude now.
Yeah.
I don't know what he was like then, but he's a very nice dude now. And you look at him, you look at other people who have been, particularly let's talk, you know, 30, 40 years ago, in institutions where they might have been assaulted or
particularly in like boys' homes and stuff like that. You know, all of a sudden they've been removed from their families for whatever reason. Maybe there's been a death. Maybe something's happened. Then they're being looked after by the state or by a church group. Then other horrible things happen to them there. Then they go into juvie. Something happens to them there. I'm not sure what happened in Grafton. What was the arrangement there?
Grafton was where the intractables. So these were the prisoners that were causing other prisoners in prisons that the corrective services couldn't control them. So they all bundled them all together and sent them up to Grafton. And the Grafton welcome was you get out of the prison van and you're attacked with batons and all that. It was accepted. So that was a way of dealing with it. It was a punishment prison, but it created a lot of violent people. Mm. And, you know, corrective services, I don't want to bash corrective services because I'm hearing it from the prisoners' point of view. There's some really good people in there trying to make a difference within the prisons, and that's important to get across. But that was just, you know, you're looking at the 70s. The world was a little bit different. Oh, these are bad bastards. What are we going to do? We're going to put them in there, and if they misbehave, we're going to break them.
Mm.
And that's what they did, you know. Bernie was in solitary confinement, and he told the story about he was trying to stay sane. He found a button because it was just black, and he was in there for months. And so he'd throw the button around in his cell, and that would occupy his brain because he'd look for the button by feel all around the cell, and sometimes he'd find it quickly. Other times it might take him a day, but that gave his day a purpose. So you get put in that environment, and you wonder how you would turn out. And then, Russell Manser. Yeah, he got sent to he grew up in Mount Druitt, came from a good family, but just, you know, saw the wild streaks, saw the gangsters, and thought that's the life I want to live. Knocked off cars, as people did, and then sent to a boys' home and was sexually assaulted by the people, you know, and everyone was getting sexually assaulted there. And he's got this program called Voice of a Survivor, which is talking about institutional sexual assaults and sexual abuse. And, he turned himself into a tough guy, like he is a tough guy, because he didn't want that to happen to him again. And he got sent to Long Bay as a 17-year-old. The judge was punishing him because he came from Mount Druitt and stole a car on the North Shore and he needed to be taught a lesson. Get sent there and was sexually abused there as a kid in an adult prison. So, yeah, how are you going to turn out if that type of thing happens? So it's not justifying everything they do. There's some people who've got no excuses and they're just born bad and they'll be bad for the rest of their lives. But it's interesting having a look at some of the journeys that people have gone through. There's another person I spoke to, Wilma Robb. Her parents couldn't look after her and she was put in Parramatta Girls Home. And the brutality, she never committed, she hasn't got a criminal offence. She's in her 70s now, a lovely lady, really, you know, just a beautiful soul. But when you look at what happened to her as a child and how she was brutalised, like a face being smashed in and teeth knocked out and just horrendous things for a young girl that hadn't done anything wrong, didn't have parents that could look after her. And so those type of people have sort of opened my eyes to different things. And that's sort of the journey I've been on, because I've left the cops and, yeah, that was my thing. One day I was a cop, you know, the cop's cop. That was my life, and that was taken away from me literally overnight. So I had to steer my passion somewhere else, and, I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Yeah, and people love it. They love the jube. People cannot get enough of the Jew. Mate, I was at your show in Newcastle with the great Rob Galton. And people were there. There were 40-year-olds throwing knickers up on the stage. It was beautiful.
That's
it was
funny.
I couldn't believe it. I was just I knew you were good at what you did.
Yeah.
But I went to the show not knowing how you were going to do it.
Yeah.
And it was an immersive experience. It was great. It was fantastic. And people, they loved it. They were sticking around out the front waiting for you to come out afterwards, but you were too busy having a good time out the back. But it was just, it was really, really cool. And kudos to you and Rob for creating an amazing show.
Well, there's a history to that show. Like when it was put to me to do this live stage show, like I'm comfortable talking in public. I did that a lot when I was in the police. You know, you're doing media stand-ups or you know, presentations. But this was completely different. This is people are coming to see you to be entertained. And it was sort of I was reluctant when I was approached to do it. And then they threw Rob Carlton in the mix, and Rob, who's an actor, been in the industry his whole life, really talented fellow and a good mate of mine. We've been mates for years. He said, no, we can do this, and this will be great. You've got 1,000 stories. We'll put it on stage. It'll be fantastic. I thought in my stupid little mind we'd be sitting down and there'd be a Q&A, which I've done 100 times. Okay, well, that's not that hard. And people would probably walk out and go, oh, yeah, that was good. It was, we got to see, hear about crime. And Rob's going, no, stupid, this is a theatre.
Because he is a thespian.
Oh, very, my word. Very much so.
He rang me up the other week. He goes, Mr. Butterfield. I was like, who is this? He goes, oh, hey, Rob, how are you, mate?
Yeah, he is dead set a classic. So I'm thinking, okay, two chairs, and Rob will go, so why did you join the police, Gary? And I'd be like that. He's gone, no. What? Give us a story. And Rob, because he read the book for the audio book of I Catch Killers, and he's known me that long, so he knows all my stories anyway. And he's gone, okay, let's start with something powerful. And I go, well, the crime I talked about was a horrendous crime in 2004 where a young girl was abducted and the father was murdered by this notorious pedophile. And I'm always cautious doing a show that I'm not going to glorify crime. And that was something, that was a starting point. Well, I don't want to glorify crime, but I want people to have an understanding of what crime is about. So I've said, okay, let's talk about this, because people will be, just shocked by it, but understand the gravity of what we're talking about. And if you want to know the life of a homicide detective, this is smack bang. This gives you a snapshot of what it's like over 24 hours. And Rob's going, okay, well, we're going to take the audience on a journey. And I'm thinking, fuck, where are we going with this? So in the end, and you saw the show, it's coming out, and it's not what people expected from a show like that. And it was great. It was a good experience. I've never been so nervous in my life.
Well, that's what's going to be my next question, because oftentimes when I'm about to go on stage, I'm thinking to myself, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. I'm not funny.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
I felt like that 10 times, and you're a damn sight funnier than I. How it came, because it was put off twice because of COVID.
Yep.
And after it was put off the second time, it was almost in the back of my mind, okay, well, let's just let it slide.
This is the universe saying, no, don't do this.
Because I always thought, like, the podcast been successful, the book's been successful, and other things I've done, I'm thinking, okay, this is going to take that one step too far where you fall off the edge, and it's just going to be a whole crowd booing or just silent, just staring and just walking out. And, so I'm having those nightmares. And then all the planets aligned with the places opening up. So we only had about 2 or 3 weeks before the show actually started to get going. And our first two shows were at Enmore Theatre, and I...
Your first two shows were at the Enmore Theatre.
On a Saturday night.
That's madness.
I know. And so stupidly, I'm looking for Enmore Theatre. I found your show at the Enmore Theatre. Yeah, I'm watching that.
Very good.
I'm sitting at home, and it was a good show. I might
Thank
add.
Thank you very much.
But I'm sitting at home going... Fuck, there's a lot of people there. That's a bit intense.
Hey, when I walked out that night, I was terrified because we were filming that and we had to be there the entire day, which made it worse. Yes. So I was there from 10 o'clock in the morning until showtime at 9 o'clock at night. So I was just like, oh, this is just – I was panicking. Claire was like, it's going to be fine. I'm like, this is fucked. I don't want to do this.
Well, that was my narrative. So we get there, and Nick Fordham, who manages a lot of the stuff I've done, he encouraged me. He's going, no, it's great. I'm going – Nick, what if we put it up and no one comes? Mm. Like, that's going to be embarrassing. The I Catch Killers live show and there's no one there. There'll be you there and a couple of family and a few friends. He's going, no, it'll be right, mate. I'm telling you, this is going to roll. And then on the night, Rob's in the I was calling them the change room, but now I understand it's the dressing room. But he was in the change room beside me, and I could hear him doing voice warm up. And I'm thinking, what's going on? I stuck my head around the corner and Rob's getting into character and I've got nothing. I am just so nervous.
You don't need anything. I don't do that. You don't need that.
I started shadow boxing.
That's what I do. That's what I do out the back. I'm always shadow boxing because there's nothing. If you saw me before I walk on stage, I would look like the biggest nutcase of all time. Because what else do you do?
Yeah, I just had to dump some adrenaline and just shake those nerves out. And then the show went well. And then Nick Fordham, my manager, came up and gone, oh, I was so nervous. I thought we've gone too far this time. And I've gone, oh, thank you very much for telling me now. But it was a good experience. And, yeah, I enjoyed it with Rob. I took a lot from Rob, and it's given me a confidence to do a lot of other things. But it's quite intoxicating up there and telling a story and, you know, playing with the crowd. And each show that you'd know better than I did has a different feel. And you've got to, you know, work with the crowd and that. But, yeah, we had some funny times and enjoyed it. And, yeah, it was something – it's like a tick-the-box type thing. It's something that I've enjoyed doing. And I sound like a wanker, but now I can say I performed at Enmore on a Saturday night.
But that's amazing. That's a really big deal. And I think that the great thing about that particular show is you can now – you know, it wasn't – it wasn't created in a way where, you know, you go from A to B or A to Z of your life.
Yeah.
Where you can never do another show again.
Yes, yeah.
You left people wanting more. You left that going, okay, in 2 years' time, when Gary's back out, I'm definitely going to come.
Yeah, well, that's – and again, kudos to Rob, because it was – for theatre, we want to give people every emotion. And, yeah, there's tears, there's laughter, there's anger, there's shock, there's everything that covered it. And it was sort of ebbed and flowed, and I enjoyed it, and I didn't feel like it was selling out. I didn't feel like I was just going, oh, yeah, we locked up this crook, locked up that crook. It was sort of, yeah, you got to reveal a little bit of yourself, so I gave a little bit of myself in the show.
Mm.
But, yeah, it was an experience, but absolutely terrified.
Mm.
And I can normally – you know, steal myself, you go into the witness box. That's a scary time and different things that, you know, come up in life. But, yeah, walking out on the crowd, I only forgot my lines once.
Yep.
And that was terrifying. And I think it was down at Melbourne at the Entertainment Centre or whatever. It was really big hall. And I'm staring, the lights were hitting me in the face, and I'm talking. And then I went blank.
Yeah.
I went blank, and there was just this awkward silence for about 10 seconds, and then I stumbled through and Rob helped out a little bit. But that was the worst. But I also learnt you're as good as your last show, because after I did about three or four, I've gone, yeah, I got this covered. And one, I didn't, you know, wind myself up and get the right degree of nervous tension. And I thought I was a bit slack on that one. So, yeah.
I think the nerves are great.
You've got to have them, haven't you?
Because, you know, if you go out there, he's calm and collected. Like, people can feel that.
Yeah.
And I don't think they want to, because they've done everything that night to get themselves in the position where they're at your show. You know, they've got a babysitter. They've thought about it all week. They've spent their money. If you walk out there and you don't care, fuck that. You know, you'll never get them as a repeat customer.
100%. And that's where I really make the point of, you know, giving a bit of yourself to the show. So they're feeling like you're playing your part in it. And so that's why it's sort of raw and we're fairly open with what we say. But, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, and I came to your show and I came backstage and you had a big group back there and you introduced me to Graham Henry.
Yeah.
And you said, you got to meet this bloke. And I had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of him before. And you talked about him like, oh, he's a, you know, you said, you'll know this guy. So I can't remember what you said, but you were like, you'll know him.
Yeah.
I had no idea until I got in the car and Googled him. I was like, oh, my God. Claire goes, oh, I just offered him a cup of tea if he comes over. And then we Googled who he was. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And now you're mixing with completely different people and it seems like that's what you're doing for this book as well.
Yeah, it is. And, like, you know, people might say, well, what's he doing? Has he crossed sides and that? And
gone to the dark side.
Gone to the dark side. And, you know, yeah, some of the people I'm speaking to, and I'm not saying this disrespectfully, like, yeah, some of them would probably want to belt me, and they would in the right circumstances. And I've gone to functions where, you know, people, yeah, I'm looking at who have I locked up here? Have I gone after this person?
Have you run into people at shows?
Yeah, a few people have come up to me and said certain things, but it's been good, all good so far.
Anyone you locked up?
There's a few that have turned up, but I've locked up, but yeah.
And it's all going well.
Yeah, nothing personal. Okay. Speaking to these people, but I think they get where I'm coming from now. And I've been fortunate, and I think it started with Bernie Matthews, that he vouched for me, because it's a world where they do. They're not going to talk to me unless they think they're comfortable talking to me. and they understand where I'm coming from, and they're not judging me for being a copper. Some would, and I know some people I've spoken to get a bit of shit thrown back at them going, what the hell, why are you speaking to a cop? But I think when they break it all down, what I'm trying to do is just let people tell their story, and have had no real sort of incidents at this stage.
Now, you bumped back into the news recently, and I spoke to you, and I don't want to go into too much depth. I don't know what you're comfortable talking about, but you were back in the news.
Back front and centre.
Front and centre. Can you run us through what happened there?
Yeah, okay. That was, again, being dragged back into the William Tyrrell matter, which is a continual source of frustration to me, in that I think, yeah, we really need questions answered on what's going on there. That was a person, and the judgment hasn't come down. It was a judge alone. A person was suing the New South Wales Police for a malicious prosecution, which is fine, which is his right. Where I was not a little bit aggrieved, I was pissed off that the focus was on me. But that, again, I accept that. You stick your head up, but yeah. But I went to that court matter. This person was suing the New South Wales Police. He wasn't suing Gary Jubelin. And I get off the train at the railway station, there's cameras in my face, and it was reported like it's virtually, this is what Gary Jubelin has done.
Did you anticipate that reaction as you got off the train to the courthouse?
I was hoping that it wouldn't be. Like I really thought they would report it. Yeah, let's just see what this is. I played a part in the police investigation for this matter, but I'm more than comfortable in justifying it, my position. But I spent 2 days in the witness box under the majority of which was cross-examination. I had my Eye Catch Killers book there because they were quoting passages from that. And again, that's their right. But I really felt like I was I felt isolated in that I'm answering questions for what I did in the police, but I didn't have the resources of the police supporting me. I didn't have access to the documents that created 7 years ago. So look, we'll wait and see what happens when the judge comes back, whether it was a malicious prosecution. I'm comfortable in my part in it. What that counts for, who knows? But I've got documents there that support it. I was tendering documents, and I feel comfortable with the part I played in that matter. But what I didn't like about it, and I'm talking around the subject a little bit, is how it was hung out like I'm the person to blame for it. Well, no, there's all these reports I've done that everything I was doing was being sanctioned from above. So don't just hang.
Well, that was going to be my point. Is this? They're in your employer.
Yeah.
You have a boss, right?
Yes.
Like, you're not just going out willy-nilly.
No, and that 100%. So that's the thing that I tried to get across in the witness box, but I wasn't getting much help because I didn't have anyone representing my personal needs. There was people representing the New South Wales Police needs. But, two days in the witness box is not fun. I didn't want to be dragged back into it. I'm always prepared to justify my actions, so I never shy away from it. Other people say, well, no, I've left or I've gone off sick, I'm not available. Mm. I'll always front up to a court matter. And on the William Tyrrell matter, another part that became public was towards the end of last year, where they were doing a search.
In a garden, I believe.
In the garden. And, it started off all the fanfare. We've got a breakthrough. We know, we're anticipating we're going to find something.
Because that is what we thought here. We were like, oh, my God, this is – something's happening. What did you feel when you were at home hearing about this? I assume you hear about it on the news for the first time.
Look, when it came out, the phone just rings. So everyone's phoning me. Yeah. The journalists are phoning me going, what do you think this is? What do you think that is? And this is not with the benefit of hindsight. Mm. I said, look, first day – I wasn't sure. Maybe they have got a breakthrough. I haven't been on it for three years. They've been working on it. Maybe there is a breakthrough. Then I started to hear things that were coming through, and I'm not going to name the people, but the people that the accusing finger was being pointed at. And I thought, no, that's not correct. Mm. But it wasn't my position to make comments at that stage. So I just sort of sat there quietly. And then one day, my phone started about the second or third day. My phone just started going ballistic. Are you okay? Are you this? Are you that? And this is all coming up in the morning. I'm thinking, I think I'm okay. I'm at home. I'm not doing anything wrong. And all these friends and past acquaintances are reaching out. And the New South Wales Police Commissioner decided to criticise the investigation I ran. And I'm thinking, well, what do I do here? My initial reaction was just go on the front foot, and I thought about it. Do you just, yeah, if you're being criticised, do you just let it play out? Mm. I didn't really know what to do, but it became so intense. Like, I was literally on the phone for about, the whole day. I didn't sit down. I was basically on the phone with people going, what do you want to say? What do you want to say? I thought, well, stuff this. I'm going to go on and put my position forward. And I went on Ben Fordham's show, because that's who the commissioner, when he criticised the investigation. I don't want to be critical of the police, but it got to the point where if you're going to publicly criticise an investigation I ran, well, I'm going to defend myself. Mm. And so I went on, and I think I was balanced in the way I put my message across, but basically said, well, yeah, there's all these documents there. They're admissible documents. They're there, but accountable documents, I should say. They're accountable documents, and they'll show everything I've done. And in the 4 years that I ran the investigation, there was not one bit of criticism from anyone above me about the way I ran the investigation. So that, then to hear the most senior officer criticising the investigation, which I've never heard that before, and people for interstate were ringing me and saying, it's unusual, like a New South Wales Police Commissioner criticising an active investigation.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So it was unfortunate, but Isaac, the saddest thing about the whole William Tyrrell thing is how many people have been hurt in this. And I'm not including myself in that. Anything that's happened to me pales into insignificance compared to what's happened to his biological family and the Foster family. And then the rumours that have been spread and the information that's been leaked to the media, I think is quite disgraceful. And people always said, I go hard on crooks. And I did go hard on crooks. I make no apologies for that. But I would never throw people under the bus like they've been thrown under on this. And, yeah, not unless, you don't throw people under the bus like that. So you've got people that have suffered, losing a child, as in William, and then the other things that are flowing on from it. And I think people want, really want some answers. And I also look at, and I'm only talking about this because I was dragged into it, and it's a funny thing, and it's almost like if I wasn't criticised, I would respectfully stay on the sideline. But I was criticised very deliberately about the way I ran the investigation. Well, I make the comment that the way that played out in the media, everyone was certain there was a breakthrough. I've never seen a circus like...
Well, they took the media there.
Yes.
The media was there from day one. It's not like, oh, hang on, we're up at Kendall just, you know, driving around, we'll have a bit of a dig,
yeah,
see what's going on. No, the media is there from day one, like it is an announcement is about to be made.
It was like a theatre. Mm. It was Rob Carlton couldn't have done as good a job.
Well, let's not go that far. He's pretty good. Okay. He's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, maybe he could have. But it was like a theatre.
Yeah.
But every piece of material they found, it was, here's a possible breakthrough.
We found this.
Here's this, here's that. So it went on for, I think, 3 weeks. And yep. After the 3 weeks, I would have thought someone would have to front the media and answer questions. Like, you invited the media in. You invited society in to have a look at what we're doing. And then it just stopped. And there was a half-page media release saying we've concluded our search up there.
At what point does the attack or bringing you into it happened? Is that is that after the 3 weeks when they come up with nothing?
Right at the start. So it was in day two or day three.
Right,
that brought me into it, and I just hope, and I think, and we bring it all back, and I don't want it to be a slanging match between me and the police because that's ridiculous. The priority should be about, you know, let's find out what's happened to William. But if you're going to engage the media the way that the media were engaged during that search, it's a double-edged sword. You've got to be then prepared to answer questions when it doesn't play out the way that you've led everyone to believe it was going to play out. So I haven't seen anything like it in my career. So
when you were on that case and you got pulled off the case, how close do you think you were to solving it?
Look, that's a question that's often asked of me, obviously. I can't say definitively I would have solved it, and I think I'd be a bit of a wanker if you just left me on the case, I would have solved it. But I had a clear line of inquiry that I was pursuing, and I had a strategy, and I had experience, and that was all just cut off when I was taken away. So I don't want to be critical of the people that took it over, but yeah, I've said it once, I'll say it 1,000 times, I'll say it till the day I died. I never did a handover.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there was never a handover.
Yeah, and people are just ignorant if they say, well, there was no benefit from a handover. The fact that I didn't sit down and speak to the people taking over that investigation is shameful, I think. Whether it made a difference, we don't know. But what I do know about murder investigations, and that's what we have to consider William's disappearance as a murder investigation, success is on incremental millimetres. So you make one mistake, you've got to take every advantage that you've got. And why wouldn't you debrief me? Like, what was my charges weren't, I wasn't this corrupt person that was going out robbing banks or selling drugs or whatever. I recorded the conversation whilst working on the investigation. It would not have impacted on the integrity of the investigation to, a handover, a debrief. But again, I keep saying the sad part about all this is that to a degree, and I play a part in it, I suppose, just talking about the conflict, is that it's getting lost that a three-year-old child's disappeared. And, you know, as a law enforcement agency, we should be judged by our response for it.
And it becomes about you and the boss of the police. It's like, what are you talking? That doesn't. Yeah. Who cares? Yeah, let's find this kid.
When it's all said and done, that's right. Who cares?
And that's got to break the hearts of the family.
Yeah.
They see you back up there and this bloke talking to about each other. Well, not about it. You're not talking about him, but you're talking about his statements about you on a radio show.
Yeah.
Like, hang on.
Wouldn't you prefer us all working together?
Where's William?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like Claire, my wife, she's very invested in this case. Yeah. She's read the books on it and she's just, it breaks her heart as it does for a lot of people. And when all this happens, it's like, come on. Like we, I don't know. I guess you're butting your head against the wall at the same time everyone else is.
Look, it frustrates me. And I think it frustrates a lot of people that we need to find out. And one thing I do know, a lot of people come to conclusions by what's fed to the media. The police provide information to the media and the people naturally go, okay, this has happened, that's happened. I just say let's be very cautious on this one. This was a difficult investigation. I hope the facts come out, the full facts come out, and then people can make an informed judgment. The inquest, I'm not sure when the coroner's going to hand down the inquest. I believe at one stage he was going to hand down the findings, I think almost 2 years ago. It's still just sitting there. So I'd be very interested when that occurs too. So, yeah.
Completely off that topic. Let's move away from it. But obviously it needs to be spoken about. Yeah. When we talk about the path that someone follows and we talk about badness, what do you think should be done? If I have a child and they are 14 years old and they end up in a correctional facility for kids, what happens at that point? What should be looked at, do you think?
I think you can make, and this is just I'm not an expert, but from my observations of it, you've really got to try to make that, there's that dangerous period of kids where they can go off the rails. And that sort of 10, 12 to 15, 16, you can lose kids in a heartbeat. you got to really, and I talk more from a parenting point of view, but I know with my son's soccer team, I was coaching them around that age, and you could see kids that were on the right path and then just lost their way very quickly. So my thing with kids is that you've just got to watch them closely, steer them, have a good role model there for them. A lot of the kids that I see get into trouble don't have good role models. Talk about bikies. A lot of people join gangs because they're looking for that connection. So if you can give kids that connection, I'm a big believer in team sport, and I know, you know, team sport gets criticised where you hear, you know, someone doing something wrong in the NRL or whatever. But that teaches people that they've got to work together.
Yeah.
So I think that's important. But it's those early years that you've just got to watch that if the kid heads off in the wrong direction. And I think, you know, a lot of people say that the quality of the kid is you can look at by the circle of friends that they keep. And I think some kids get led astray. Then you've got, kids with horrendous upbringings. And what I've found, you know, ones that have been sexually assaulted or bashed when they're young, if one good person comes into their life, the difference that can make. And I see it time and time again, different stories where a kid is dead set heading down the road of he's going to spend half his time behind steel bars, but one good person shows them a bit of respect, interest and love, all the things that people need, that can make a hell of a difference. So, you know, if you've got someone that you're worried about heading off in the wrong direction, just stay close to them as you can and just steer them through and guide them through it. And,
we see a lot of kids now who are sort of in that Esche culture,
yeah,
where they're, you know, the scooter gangs and all that type of stuff, hanging out at train stations.
Yeah, I saw that. Scooter gang, that was
weird.
Horrendous.
It's weird. Yeah. I don't know what it is. Like, yeah. I've got friends whose son is sort of mixing around, yeah, in that sort of crew, and they don't really, like, they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
Like, they might be stealing vapes.
Yeah.
But that's it. Like, there's nothing really going on. Like, they're not like a bikie gang. Like, they're not,
yeah,
whatever they're doing, or they're not sort of going around selling drugs or anything like that. They're just sort of running around doing really annoying shit.
Yeah.
Like, they're tagging things. And, like, I hate graffiti. It does my fucking head in. Like, yeah, it's just my thing. Like, there's a house around the corner here, and the people are just about to move into it, and someone, yeah, tagged all over the house. I'm like, you fucking thing. Yeah. Did me head in. But just little things. People, yeah, seem to be doing those, yeah, and young kids. Yeah. And I don't know. And they always seem to be coming from good houses.
Yeah.
Like, they're going around robbing. They might be stealing a car.
Yeah.
You know, they're going around. They're like 14 years old stealing a car. It's like, where does this come from?
Look, and I don't, you know, I'm talking like I'm this enlightened person seeing life from a different thing. But I saw like I saw a clip on TV with the scooter gang or whatever. Mm. Young kids, 14, 15, just total disrespect. I'd like to see some hard policing come in on that line. Like, that is just not acceptable. You let them get away with that, and that's going to cause a problem down the track. And people, that's part of that gang culture, but then they'd be looking up to the bikies. There's probably been too much said about bikies of recent times, you know, all the stuff that's going on in the media at the moment. The people that I've been speaking to, the ones that have gone through that time, and they look back and go, look, the bikies, it had its moment in life, but when I look back, you know, you join a bikie gang, you're either going to end up in jail or dead, and that's generally how it plays out. So we've got to get the right role models. Talk about sport. You know, I'm a big one in team sport, but I'm also very much push the old police citizens, police boys club or police youth clubs.
Yep.
Yeah. That culture of giving kids confidence, boxing. I love boxing. That's my passion. I see kids come in and it gives them a sense of self-respect, where they don't have to prove themselves. They find out they're not as tough as they think they are because they come in and this little skinny kid will towel them up in the ring. And then they learn that if you put effort in, that effort, you know, by putting effort in, you'll get respect and you'll get reward and you'll get discipline and all that. So I think things like that can make a difference. But I'm horrified that kids, there's that sense of entitlement that think they can create havoc. Now, when I was that age, and I'm sure you would have been the same, if a policeman turned up or an adult spoke
terrified.
To me, I would have been, yeah.
Yeah.
But
I know my old man, when he was growing up in Penrith,
yeah,
St. Mary's, coppers would beat the shit out of you.
Yep.
You know, that was what would happen.
Yes.
He got put in the back of a paddy wagon one night and they did donuts around a park. And he, you know, cuffed up, hanging off the ceiling, and they, you know, skinned his arm and all that type of stuff. But you didn't fuck with him.
Yes.
You know, and I think, obviously, that's not great. No, and a copper that night beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, and you
not
can't,
great.
Yeah, and you can't allow that either.
But so, there's got to be middle ground here.
Yeah,
you know where there is a bit of fear that you're going to. There's going to be some repercussions.
Yes,
and I think these kids are just like, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, my parents, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, that total lack of respect or concern, and that is concerning. That I could see. I was watching it, and I'm thinking, this is pretty bad. Those kids, if they think they can get away with that sort of shit and there's not consequences, this is going to escalate. Like, I think the one I saw, they threw a milkshake or something over a bloke, or a glass of Coke over some poor bloke working at the shopping centre. And I thought, okay, they get away with that. If there's not consequences for that, then the next thing they'll walk up and belt someone and take their wallet. There'll be a progression because they got no fear. So, yeah, it is concerning, but I would like the police, that respect, to come back for police, and it doesn't have to be. And I know the stories, and we've all got the stories of, you know, like happened to your old man, but there's still got to be that authority and there's a point in time. And I've always said when I was a cop, You could diffuse situations, but you diffuse situations without escalating it. Like, you don't come in dramatically. You talk to someone, you diffuse the situation, and then. But when you've got to draw the line in the sand, you draw the line in the sand. And okay, well, you're about to feel the weight of the law come down.
Well, you got to have some power. If you don't have any power, like, people call police because they have power.
Yeah.
If you don't have any power, what are you going to do? Just try and talk people. Like, when I used to work in security.
Yep.
And you have a female who's carrying on or trying to fight. Yep. You have no power. Like, exactly. You're just going, can you please stop? Yeah. But that's what police seem to have, particularly with young people right now.
Yeah.
They're just like, can you not do that? And they take it to their parents, and the parents can't do anything either. I mean, I see this with my own family, right? So when I was growing up, if mum threatened me with dad, I was shit scared. Now my brothers, who are, you know, coming up into their 20s now, back when they were, you know, in their late teenage years or whatever, like, if mum said, oh, can you do that? They just go, nah. And dad would go, I can't make them. But when I was a kid, I was terrified.
Oh, I know. My household was the same. Dad's coming home.
Ooh. Oh, shit. Like, you're scared. You're like, oh, wait until your father gets home. And now they're just like, bring it on.
Yeah.
Let's go.
I know. And that's that. We've got to get that right balance, haven't we? We've got to get that right mix, because if we get it wrong, we're going to have this whole generation of people that
are just out
of control.
But that ego shift and leaving your ego at the door is great with combat sports, as you said, with boxing. It's the same with jiu-jitsu and MMA training and that type of stuff. Learning that, you know, learning skills, learning how to fight, really important. Something that I wish I did as a kid.
Yep.
But learning also that someone can fuck you up very easily and you don't know if it's going to come or not.
And what I also find is that the kids that and it translates into adult life, if you know you can look after yourself, you can walk away from more things because you don't have to prove yourself. If your insecurities, maybe he could belt me, but if you know, I can belt that bloke, I don't have to prove myself. Yeah, sorry, mate, you're a tough guy. See ya.
Yeah, you might end up carrying a knife if you don't know that you can handle yourself.
Yeah, well, that's a concern too.
We saw that up in Brisbane recently. I don't know if you saw that video of the young man being stabbed in the neck. I saw it come up on Twitter and I was just watching it. I didn't know what it was. And I was really taken back.
Yeah.
Like, you've just seen this young man's life end.
Yeah. And that's what people don't realise with knives. They don't think they're guns and they think, oh, well, I can be tough with a knife. But I've seen too many times in homicide where one stab wound in the wrong spot causes someone's life. Talking about the policing too, but I do feel sorry for police in this day and age, because the old, you take them around the back and give them a kick up the ass. Could you imagine if a police officer did that now and it would be filmed and it would be the most outrageous thing? They'd lose their job.
It's not their fault.
Yeah.
It's not the police's fault at all. It's, I guess it's politics at this point.
It is. There is a bit of politics, but I think that, home, that discipline's got to be instilled in the kids, but they've still got to have respect for the police. And if we lose respect for the police, I think it's in America where, California, around or LA, where the police are not intervening if the offence is of a minor nature under a certain amount.
If you steal under $1,000 or something, they don't even prosecute you at all.
They don't come out. Yeah.
That's mad.
It is mad because you can imagine how that would the flow on effect from there.
What does that teach people? What does that teach an entire generation? Yeah. That the cops aren't going to do shit.
Well, you start to take it. Imagine if you're walking down or you've got a bike and someone's just stealing your bike because it's under $1,000 and you can't do anything. What are you going to do? You'll take law into your own hands.
Yeah, and everyone's got a gun.
It's scary.
Like when I went to America, we went to a gun show in Florida and it was great fun. It was great. You just walk around with a gun. It's amazing. But, you know, do you trust everyone with a gun?
No. I think one of the good things that came from the Port Arthur massacre was taking guns off the street. And I was in the police at the time, and I remember people would just come in with bags of guns and just put them on the counter at the police station. And, yeah, those domestic situations that escalate, people do stupid things at particular points, and when you've got a gun, it's too easy, and you pull the trigger and someone's dead.
And it is so easy.
Yeah.
You know, I love shooting guns. Yep. I'm a big fan of guns, and I understand the American point of view where, hey, we have the right to bear arms. I get it. I get where you're coming from, but also I know a lot of crazy people who I don't want to have a gun. But also, if something happens at my house, I would prefer to have a weapon.
Yes.
So it's one of these things where you got to weigh up. It's like, hey, I should have a gun, but no one else.
Now, that would be.
That's how I think it should work.
If you could bring that in, that'd be cool.
Yeah. But they are fun.
I get the gun and no one else has got the gun.
But I see people all the time that I'm like, thank fuck they don't have a gun.
Yeah.
Or teachers. They're talking about giving teachers in schools guns.
That scares me.
I've had some substitute teachers that I reckon would have turned and sprayed the entire class.
I had some crazy teachers in my time.
You did?
But there was one, I won't mention the name, but it was funny because we were having a a long time ago, and he's since dead, but he assaulted me, like seriously dragged me out of a window. And I was talking to
out of a window?
Out of a window at music in the music class.
How does someone drag someone out of a window?
It was a big window, and I just happened to be sitting there, and the person sitting beside me said something offensive to this teacher as he's walking past. He thought it was me.
Right.
And he dragged me out of the window. Then he put me on detention, and it was quite weird. Just, yeah, me and this creepy-looking teacher just standing, staring at me day and day in, and to the point where I said, no, I'm out of here. I wasn't a real tough guy. Mum was on the canteen. I said, you go, good. Tell my mum because she's doing canteen duty. But I was speaking to Graham, and Graham apparently belted that teacher because he went through the same school.
Really?
And I said, okay, so that's what's happened to him. So
Graham's quite a bit older than you.
Yeah. He's, I think he would have been probably 10 years ahead of me. Sort of thing. But his reputation preceded him growing up around Epping.
So this poor teacher's been kicked the shit out of by Graham Henry, and then he's just picking people in classrooms. He goes, I can take him. Come here.
So
that's the flow-on effect.
The flow-on effect.
So he's had the shit kicked out of him by a gangster or a soon-to-be gangster. And then he's just turned. He's turned bad straight away.
I think that's what happened. Actually, it's a bit sad. I think he had a mental health issue. But
being a teacher, and I know they love a protest, the teachers, and I get it. All right, you get paid enough though. Calm down. maybe pay coppers more. Maybe you should pay coppers more because they're out there dealing with crazy people. Well, so are teachers though. I know a lot of crazy kids.
Yeah.
I can only imagine the shit that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. I thought I wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Nah. Looking at it now, knowing what particularly teenage boys are like, I could not think of anything worse.
It would be I couldn't imagine it. Like it would be terrifying having those kids come at you the whole time. And the just way, exhausting.
Like I'm sure you saw it as a kid too. Yeah. Some of the breakdowns that teachers have, like when you make a teacher cry, like there's a part of you that's like, yes, we did it. And there's another part you go, oh, shit, we're bad. We're bad people.
I had a teacher that, and I was in year 11, I think it was. So I wasn't driving, 16, and we had to go to a play. We went to the theatre, and he was our English teacher. And he's picked us up and taken us to this play. Like it was all people getting how they could to the play. I remember we walked in there and he had all this alcohol shoved up his shirt and it all fell out when we were walking into the theatre. And, we were 16, year old kids. And then we're finished. Oh, this sounds like the story's going to end really bad. It didn't. Then he invited us back to his place.
Oh, what?
After the play to have more drinks.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, so it was just, and yeah, we're at 15, 16. And then I remember, like, we were drunk. There was about three of us back at his place. And then he's driven us home. And I remember pulling him up, but when he pulled up out the front of my place, he nearly crashed because he was driving drunk and all that. And you think, they're teachers. Yeah. They're
Well, teachers are real people, and that's what you learn when you leave school. You have a friend that becomes a teacher, and yes. Then they're going to school every day, and you go, I don't try, because I got a mate, his name is, he's a teacher. I don't know how he is, he's not a bad person, but he's just an idiot. I don't know how he's allowed to teach, like, humans that are growing.
What's
like,
his name? I'm not going to make any.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't mention his name. Maybe actually, Connor, when you edit this, could you bleep his name out?
Mr. Bleep.
Mr. Bleeper. No, he's a lovely man and he's a great teacher, woodwork teacher, allegedly. But yeah, just these, like he goes to school every day and has never left school.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it. No wonder they love a day off protesting.
All the protesting, but you got to give a good teacher can make a difference. Like we've all had those good teachers in your life.
Mm.
And I think back to a couple that really left an impression on me and sort of steered me in the right direction. So, yeah, I do respect teachers because they play such an important role and probably more so now, you know, the way society is and broken marriages and different things. So, yeah.
Back to guns. What do you think the Americans should do with the gun laws? Or what should they do with people having access to semi-automatic or automatic weapons?
Well, the right to bear arms. That's when, you know, I'm pissed off with you, but just you stand there so I can load my gun.
Yep.
And, you know, with the
The old school sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So I understand that. But with these assault rifles and that, there's no place for civilians to have those weapons. They're dangerous. Yeah, they can kill a lot of people. So you're not going to – I don't know. I don't understand the culture enough, but it appears you're never going to be able to wind it back completely. But when you hear those massacres at those schools and that's not enough.
And they're crazy. They're all the time too. Like it's a daily occurrence that a mass shooting happens there.
That's not enough to jolt them back into, okay, let's take an extreme action. I don't know what will. So if they got to, okay, you can have a gun, but you're only allowed one shot. You know, just not a semi-automatic or an assault rifle. They're called assault rifles because they, you know, could you argue
that a car is as dangerous? Like you could drive that into a group of people?
Most definitely. But let's not give people ideas with cars. But I think it's the build up with a firearm. It's just angry person. And this is I'm referencing my book, which is a bit
go and buy it. By the way, if you haven't bought it already, go to Amazon.
I had a copy of it here.
I know. I was expecting that. Yeah. When is it out on on sale?
September. But let's not cheapen my comment here.
Go and get the fuck.
With Julian Knight before the Hoddle Street massacre, the build up and like researching that.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, I think it was five or seven people shot. He shot a police helicopter. It was a pretty bad one. I think it was before the I'm not sure. It was in Victoria, but I'm not sure if it was before the one in Tasmania. But things that built up where he just decided I've had enough, and it's sort of he joined the army. He was kicked out of the army, or an issue happened happened there because he was charged with an assault. And then he came back home, but his bedroom wasn't set up anymore. Someone else had, at home. And then he was going out. He wanted to go out that night and his car broke down. The battery was dead or whatever. And you could just see it just sort of escalate. And it was almost like if you put a timeline there, you'd go, okay, that happened. If we could have circumvented that, then that happened. Shit, I've got nothing to live for. I'll show you. And he gets his firearm and goes out and starts shooting people. Firearms put the idea into people's heads. I think in our brain, the car is transport. Firearms are killing. To kill people. So if someone's got something going wrong in their head, that they feel like killing people, they go to the firearm because that's there. So that would be the difference.
And that one sounds so different to, say, like the Las Vegas shooting.
Yeah.
Have you seen the footage of that dude walking in with countless luggage cases over days and days and days?
That was the one shooting from
that.
Yeah, yeah. That was
I was watching this short little doco on it, and it's got all the security camera footage. So he turns up, he disappears with his car, comes back, more luggage, comes back, more luggage, and he's got, I don't know how many guns he ended up with and how much ammunition, but it was like
that was
large arsenal.
And how many, there was 70 people or something.
Something crazy.
It was crazy, crazy numbers. But one thing I think, and the media have to play a part in this, and we all do too, I'd love to see any situations like that. We never mention their name. Yeah, because I think some of these lunatics, well, you're not paying attention to me. Look, you will now. I'll be on the front page of the paper. Just play the victims' names. Talk about the victims, not talk about the offender. That might be a way.
Do you think just a blanket ban on mentioning who this is? Yeah. Because people, they then want to know more, I feel.
Yeah.
Like that would be my concern is it's like, well, they're not telling us who it is. It's this guy, and here's his photo, and they share it.
You're right. So you'd have to give a description, but let's not be the Martin Bryant, that type of thing. So a name that we're all familiar with. Mm. Let's take that away. So it could be that weird dude that was down living in Tasmania, and he did this, did that, but not his name. So take that out of play.
Yeah, and I understand where you're going with that, because it is, a lot of these people have nothing to live for. Or they are severely depressed people, they're sad, they want to have an impact somewhere.
Yeah.
And they see their only impact being, remembered as a horrible person, but they are remembered nonetheless.
Yeah.
And to remove that, maybe that takes a bit of power away from it.
Take it away. So, we'll never stop it completely, but, minimize it as much as we can.
And you can't. You crazy is synonymous with humans. Yeah. Like there's always going to be a crazy human. If in Australia there's 26 million people, or one in a million chance happens 26 times a day, let's say.
Yeah.
There's going to be just insane people. And we've seen it with people running down the street and attacking people and, assaulting people with Martin Bryant. And I think a lot of listeners may not know the Martin Bryant story, but basically a mass shooting in Port Arthur in Tasmania. Yeah. And that was the reaction was the Australian government basically took guns off people, or made it very, very hard.
Made it very, very hard
to get a firearm. And I mean, you think to yourself, how many more people in Australia would have committed suicide if guns were available to everyone? Because that's the big one in America too that people don't really talk about is how many people commit suicide via a firearm, because it's quick.
It puts that idea in people's heads.
I could end it so quickly because I've got a gun there.
Yeah, because it's a weapon that's going to take your life. So I think that's, that comes into play as well. And, we've had a lot of suicides with police, and most of the ones I think of, they're all been with guns.
Mm.
But ones I've attended, they've been gun-related. So it's there. You're thinking, well, okay, that's to kill. I want to take my life. So, there's concerns there.
Yeah, mate, I want people to go out and get your book, because it's insane to think about this guy who you've seen in the media, and you've seen that he's in courtrooms and all this type of stuff. But you're a great storyteller. And that's what people, until they read the book, until they see the show, they don't understand. And that is why you should go and check out Gary's book right now, which is available at
all best-selling bookstores.
All best-selling bookstores. It will be number one in Australia. That's what we need to get to.
Yeah, it's coming out in September, I think. Father's Day. Good Father's Day.
It's a great Father's Day present.
There you go.
Now, can I ask you this? Are you happy to stick around for an extra 15 minutes for the Patreon exclusive content? We have this section of the show called the sealed section, where we delve into things a little bit deeper. We talk about things that we probably shouldn't talk about.
I can keep my clothes on.
Well, mate, if there's the 40-year-old women watching this, Gary's going to join OnlyFans on the sealed section. All right, so let's go over to the sealed section right now on Patreon. Go and check it out. It costs $1 a month. Go and support the podcast. But if you don't want to do that, go and buy Gary's book as well. Badness. It's available in all good bookstores and bad bookstores. Do bookstores even exist anymore? Can you get it on Amazon?
You probably could.
Go and buy it. All right? I'll put a link to it somewhere. Anywhere. Patreon. Right now. I hear him chatting the noise. Move too quick. Can't stop for the talking. I hear him chat with the boys. Man so tough, but man's keep walking.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.